Welcome to the Weekend Warriors Fishing Podcast, presented by 13 Fishing Canada. Make your own luck. We're here to scratch that angling itch and talk everything fishing. Join us as we sit down with special guests from across the industry. Now, here's your hosts, Brandon Cater and Logan Lewis.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Weekend Warriors Fishing Podcast. My name is Brandon, and I got Logan here with me. We got a pretty great episode with Craig from Angler's Edge Mapping. So this is a Canadian company out of Manitoba that's really, really kind of taking their mapping game to the next level. You know, they're really broadening the lakes that they're sonaring. They're really coming into Saskatchewan. But yeah, we'll dive into that a little bit more in the interview. We got to give a quick shout out to our friends over at 13 Fishing. Go use our code Weekend Warriors, get 15% off of Rapella.ca, all of their brands. And of course, our friends over at the Saskatchewan Wildlife Federation.
Yeah. So I, as far as 13 there, picked up a couple poppers. When this episode comes out, I will be on my first day in Costa Rica. We were kind of talking about before the top of the episode here. I've taken four rods there. It's a family vacation, mind you. Four rods, large tray, one of the larger Rapala trays there that they got now. Some terminal tackle, some stuff. I'm going to try and catch some bait fish and maybe just sit there, cast out a line with the bait fish on and wait for a big fish to bite it, maybe while I sip on a beer. Because I think you can probably do that in Costa Rica, right?
It's a fishing trip and you're taking along a little bit of family.
Yeah, it's funny how that works. But yeah, no, that's the plan there. So I'm excited to use some of those poppers. They also had some cool saltwater X-wraps as well. So definitely be diving into those. I do have a housekeeping note from last episode when we announced the March Madness Classic.
Yes,
sir. Which we should talk about a little bit more as well. But we said episode 64. And it was actually episode 65, I realized, once I was editing it, because Jesse was a two-parter. So if you haven't checked out Jesse's episodes, it's a two-parter. Go and listen to those as well. But I guess
episode 63 and 64.
Right. So last episode was 65. Now we're on 66. This is just a one-parter.
66 episodes of the Weekend Warriors Fishing Podcast. Yeah. Can you believe it?
Look at us. Who would have thought? No, I did mention there. The Weekend Warriors March Madness Classic. That is happening again this year, obviously, if you listened to the last episode. There's a couple things that I wanted to mention, some clarifications there for some of the stuff in that one. So obviously, some of the spark notes there that we mentioned from last episode, $3,000 guarantee from us. There is three prize pools. There is the that get cash. There is the adult division that's all cash prizes. So there is $1,000 towards the pike leaderboards, $1,000 towards the walleye leaderboards, and $1,000 towards the burbot leaderboards. So that payout is subject to change if we get a bunch more people entered. So we're guaranteeing that at least $1,000 will go towards each leaderboard. So the top three are going to be paid out. You can check out the payout structure on the Angler's Atlas event page there for the classic. But anyways, we're guaranteeing that $3,000 as soon as we reach that threshold of that $3,000 and the entries, boom, every other entry after that goes right back into the prize pool. So I think that has potential to get quite big. We had about almost 60 people last year and only 2 days of advertising. And so I think we have a chance to really blow this thing up. It's Saskatchewan wide, fish it from March 1st to 17th. You get 3 weekends in there. And all you need is a bump board and a fish to be able to enter into this tournament, basically. So that's pretty
and
sweet.
And you got 17 days.
Yeah, 17 like, days. You can fish any of those 17 days.
So much fishing if you want to.
Yeah, if you want to. We had some awesome entries last year. I think just over 100 fish or something like that entered. You can enter every fish you catch if you want to. A lot of people are just entering kind of the biggest one they caught, which makes sense too. But that's something that's pretty sweet. Wanted to mention that Rapala, 13 Fishing, and Strike Masters come on again this year to sponsor the youth prizes. So we have an adult and a youth category. So with that, the adult entry fee is $60. The youth entry fee is $30. With the youth prizing, youth is 15 and under for this tournament. youth prizing, there is going to be a bunch of stuff coming from Rapala Strike Master 13 as far as product
for and those good stuff.
Good stuff. I know, like, my little cousin won some of the stuff last year and he was jacked about that stuff. He sent me a picture of all the stuff he'd got as far as there's some nice ice fishing combos, tons of tackle. We all know you can never have enough tackle. So that's definitely something to check out. If you and you're out fishing and you're taking your kid with you or whatever, put them in there. Like last year, I think we only had 4 or 5 youth in there. So the odds of them winning something are pretty high. So,
and I think the prizes, the insight that we have so far, the prizes for the youth are going to be a lot better too this year. So
yeah,
definitely if you got kids, I think the youth category is actually 15 and under. So if you're, you know, in your teens, you're 15 years old or younger, definitely go enter because there is some sick prizes.
Yeah, no, just another, like the stuff that came last year was pretty cool and this year shaping up to be the same. So definitely check that out. Like I said, especially if you're taking your kid out with you fishing or whatever, I mean, enter those, both those categories and you guys can have some fun. It just adds another element to it, right? Like you don't have to, it's not like it's a $500-$600 entry fee, like some summer tournaments and stuff like that, right? Like you're out there fishing already the way I see it. And it just adds like that other element of excitement. Like I was out fishing with some people who were fishing it last year. Obviously I'm not in it, but just the excitement around every burbot they caught, they're just jacked. Cause like you get to pretty quick turnaround too. You enter that fish and once it's approved, you can see where you're sitting on the leaderboard. But I guess with that, with measuring the fish, I also wanted to mention some notes there. So we have a rule. There's none of those ruler type bump boards allowed in the event, but you can have obviously your commercially made bump boards. If you are making your own bump board, we need to have a picture of that bump board sent to us so that we can verify it, that everything's good with it. So when I say making one, people will take whether it is some kind of measuring tape, they cut it off at whatever 50 inches and they've got it on like a 2x4 to bump the fish's nose up against with a 2x4 on the bottom. We get a picture of that. We can tell everything's good. That tape is like whatever screwed down to the board kind of thing. We just want to make sure that obviously that everything's fair with that. And kind of rolling into that fair side of things as well. If you check out the rules, there is a mouth closed rule for the fish this year. I know we didn't have it last year. You could have the mouth open, closed, halfway open, whatever. Didn't matter. Just with some of my experience now fishing the Pro-Am and the Vanity and seeing how they measure all these fish, it kind of just keeps things more consistent, right? So we do have a closed mouth rule. In some of those events that have this, it's a disqualification. You get a 0 if the mouth isn't fully closed. I didn't want to do that because I don't think that's totally fair to lose. Say it's a 28 inch walleye. I don't think it's fair to lose all 28 inches just because the mouth is open a little bit. So we just have I think walleye, burbot won't really be an issue. Their mouths are kind of always closed, but I think walleye and burbot lose 3 centimeters off their total length if the mouth is found to be not closed. Yeah, not closed. And then pike is 5 centimeters off of it. So it doesn't sound like a lot, but I'll tell you, that was the separation between last lots of the pike last year.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, it came down to centimeters.
Yeah.
It was crazy.
So I just wanted to mention that because that's something new for this year. I know lots of people that are fishing it obviously are listening to the pod as well. So just watch for that. When you're measuring the fish, it's the fish's right side down, belly to belly when you're taking that picture. Just kind of keeps everything the same. It's a lot easier to make sure everything's good. And that's just kind of the, I don't know if you want to say like the, that's kind of what comes with the conditions of a catch photo release tournament, right? So just wanted to let everyone know that. But I think that's pretty well the biggest things other than if you are entering after the tournament has started, can totally do that. Like we said, there's 17 days, so it's tons of time. Just know that we have an 8-hour freeze on your account entering fish if you enter after the event has begun. So just keep that in mind. If you're thinking you want to go fishing tomorrow or whatever, it's a Friday, you want to go fish Saturday in the event, enter the night before because you can't enter once you get to the ice and expect to enter a fish right after that. Because obviously we don't want people just fishing, waiting till they catch a big fish, then entering their fish. Because once again, not fair to people who put their money ahead and were competing this whole time. So that's just another tidbit there. Kind of a long a little bit of a, I don't know, rant or whatever that was there for that. But I kind of wanted to get that stuff out there because those are some of the stuff that is in the fine print. I know I'm bad for reading anything really. Once it's the first couple sentences, I kind of stop reading lots of the time. So if people are like me, they might not have saw that in the rules. So if you can always message us, email us, we'll answer right away. I know I had tons of messages when last year's was going on. If you have any questions, stuff like that, just let me know. We'll try and get things figured out. But I think that's kind of it. That's all I had. I don't know if you had anything else for the tournament, Brandon.
No, man. I think the biggest thing is just making sure that, you know, everybody's getting an opportunity that's fair. And the more people, the more prizing that's available. So, I mean, spread the word, right? If you got friends, family that are going to be out fishing in March, get them to enter. And everybody's got a better opportunity of taking home some more money.
Yeah, so, for sure.
With that being said, I mean, we're super excited. You know, we're still over a month away. Actually, no, we're 1 month away.
Exactly, from this recording
today
date.
Today is February 1st. We are 1 month away from the Weekend Warriors March Madness Classic.
At the time of recording, not when this podcast comes
out. At the time of recording, yes.
Yeah, I just want to add one thing here. As far as the Saskatchewan Wildlife Federation, get your memberships. Like I said last episode, I just got mine. I got some buddies to go and get theirs. Comes with lots of great stuff, and we might be working with them on something for the tournament as well. So definitely check that out.
Yeah, without further ado, you know, we have a really great episode here with Craig. We hope you enjoy it. It's going to get in depth on some mapping, how they go about doing all of that, and some Saskatchewan lake talk as well.
We got a little different episode here for us today. This is going to be kind of the first of its kind for us. We've never had anyone like Angler's Edge mapping that we have today. We have Craig McDougal from them. Just take a quick second here, Craig, to introduce yourself and the company and kind of let people know what you guys are up to.
Okay, thanks, Logan and Brandon, for having me on here. I'm one of the guys behind a Winnipeg-based company called Angler's Edge Mapping. And we basically got frustrated with the quality of maps available to anglers. We're big anglers ourselves. We got frustrated with the quality of maps available and kind of started taking matters into our own hands. The company got started in about 2012, and before too long we were producing digital maps compatible with Lowrance sonars, as well as printed maps to hang on the cottage wall. And more recently, we have also partnered up with an app company called Avenza Maps so that we can get our maps out onto mobile devices, phones, and iPads and that sort of thing.
I'm excited that you said the Avenza map, because I had that app on my phone too. And I was looking over the website and stuff today, and I don't know if it's on there, if I missed it or whatnot, but I was like, I wonder if these are the same guys, because I've used it at Clearwater. And so was that you guys that mapped that as well?
Yes, we mapped Clearwater 3 or 4 years ago, I think.
Okay, yeah, so I used that. We went, when was that? 2 years ago, I think I was there. And so it was during the summer, and we used that. And it's so nice that it can follow you on your phone like that if you don't have a Lowrance, right? And basically, we were able to go all over the place, check out what we wanted to do before we even stepped foot on the water, and it was quite nice. So I was happy to hear you say that. So I guess when you say frustrated with the mapping that was out there, I guess for us up here, that could be the lack of mapping as well that's out here, right?
Yeah, I think we had it pretty bad in Manitoba too. Like, there was a lot of lakes that literally had nothing. There was some lakes that had something, but it was, you know, not very good based on old data, old government data that just, you know, didn't really cut it, especially on the Canadian Shield where there's a lot of hazards, rocks and reefs and whatnot. Yeah. Like, I grew up on the Winnipeg River. I grew up in a town called Pinawa, and I basically had a home range of about 5 kilometers upstream of Pinawa, and the river went for another 35 before it hit a dam. But I was so scared to go further because, you know, you might not make it back in one piece kind of thing. Like, I wrecked multiple lower ends. Yeah. My dad wrecked the lower end on that section of river. And so it it kind of scares you into, you know, a little tiny little area. And so when we started mapping this, it opened up a world of opportunity. And it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I'm sure you get to see a lot of pretty cool places too.
Yeah, right? Oh, for sure. We've been on the water all over the place, especially in the last few years. We've been branching out into northern Manitoba and into Saskatchewan, northwest Ontario as well.
Nice.
Sorry, I was just gonna jump in there and say, yeah, because like it seems like Ontario always has great mapping, right? So the fact that, you know, there is a focus on the central part of Canada is nice. But you know, you mentioned like Lawrence. How did that come about? Like when you guys first started, was there an agreement with them right off the bat, or what is that process to get a company like that on board to utilize your mapping?
Well, Lawrence kind of made a decision way back in 2014 that they were going to work with small developers. So they kind of made it known that, you know, we're willing to work with you. And we reached out to them and got something formally developed. And they were doing the same thing with companies all over Europe and South Africa, Australia. So they made a really good decision there, I think, and it got a lot of people interested in sort of developing products, high quality products.
Yeah, it's almost like crowdsourcing that information, right? Rather than them having to worry about going and mapping that all themselves, you're able to kind of get people from all over, kind of dot everyone all over the place and get those things going, right?
Yeah. It's kind of like crowdsourcing. It kind of is I would call it a grade above crowdsourcing, because the onus is on those developers to, you know, take really good care of the data and you know, their name is, you know, at stake, I guess, if you will. There's other crowdsourcing options have developed and taken off over the years, but they always, you know, the data's, I shouldn't say always, but sometimes the data is a little bit questionable. You know, water levels change and, you know, it doesn't really get reflected in those outputs.
Right. And I guess this is kind of going down the line of topics here, but I guess you probably saw those water level changes a lot with Diefenbaker, right?
Yeah, Dief's a challenge from a processing standpoint when it fluctuates so much. I'd hope to have the Diefenbaker East map released by now, but we're just still processing data. There's so much data.
Right.
It's a really intricate lake, actually. I had no idea. We've done other lakes in Saskatchewan, and they're not like Dief. Like, first of all, they're nowhere near as deep, but they're also not generally as intricate, with little coulees and valleys and old river channels, and it's really cool.
Yeah. Well, and that's kind of what I always, anytime I go to Dief, like, just so you have an idea, I don't know if you've driven around the Chain Lakes or through Buffalo Pound, stuff like that, with it being in the valley there. I always just look at Buffalo Pound when I'm out at the cabin there, and I'm like, this is basically, if Diefenbaker was empty, it'd be something similar to this. Or if you took Buffalo Pound and filled it up to the top, is what I kind of like to imagine Diefenbaker as, because it's just, you can tell with the, like you said, lots of those coulees and lots of those arms that are going off. Like, I'm like, if you just totally drain this, like, it's pretty well what it would look like, right? Like, that's what makes up for that being so intricate. And it makes for some great fishing opportunities, because like you said, we don't have a lot of that here with those arms and whatever coulees, stuff like that. So I totally agree with you there. But I guess kind of going back to the business, was it always a plan to kind of turn it into a business? Like, was that kind of like, we're going to start doing this, or?
Well, not really. I think people sometimes will laugh at our whole business trajectory. No, we were just hoarding data, right? Like, we collected data and we started using it and started catching a lot of fish, and it was getting pretty darn expensive. With the gas, and admittedly gas was a lot cheaper than it is now, back in 2012-ish. But the lower ends and props and stuff add up too. And so we initially just were trying to recover some of our costs. The first thing we started selling was printed maps. And that was just to try to recover some of our costs. And we were only selling them to our friends. We weren't really promoting it at all. And then we just kind of realized, well, this is getting kind of crazy. Like we're going in debt pretty bad. I'm bankrolling it, and my brother and my dad are kind of bankrolling it. And, we just decided, well, if we're going to get serious about this, we really have to, you know, start trying to sell some maps versus just hoarding the data for ourselves. So we did in about 2014. It coincided with that Lowrance licensing agreement, and we started taking it a little more seriously.
Nice.
So is it just still a full family business, or have you guys branched out to a size where you actually employ quite a few people too, or is it just still strictly kind of, you know, five people or less?
It's expanded. My brother Rob, he's the vice president. Yep. And he's still involved. My dad has passed on, unfortunately. But there's about, I don't know, 15 or so guys that contribute fairly intensively. And then another, I don't know, 10 or so that are, you know, loosely involved. We've got a few pretty high-end pro staff in Manitoba. Matt Cornell from Bruin Outfitting and Guiding. Mike Boris and Derek Stannard, who are pretty big tournament guys out here. Quite a few people involved.
Cool. Because it sounded like it started out kind of like a family, you know, affair. And then, you know, I wasn't too sure if it was still kind of that tight knit or, I mean, obviously if you're expanding to so many different provinces, right, it becomes pretty wearing too. If you're going to be driving around mapping all these lakes, like you got to get more and more people involved.
Yeah, so. Exactly. It's still, I would call it a very tight knit group. Like we're pretty good friends with everybody that's involved. You got to kind of be a certain type of individual to want to do this, like to want to spend your, your free time driving around a lake and not fishing. It's just, you got to be different. That's all.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's pros and cons.
I just want to drag a crank everywhere, at least to have something. In the water.
Exactly.
Yeah. No, I guess. So kind of transitioning to the lakes themselves, what kind of criteria are you looking for when you guys decide, okay, we're going to do this water body? Is it like a by demand thing from the comments and stuff you get, or do you guys have some kind of system that helps you choose?
Personal preference.
There is a
whatever
lot,
like they want to
no,
fish.
There is a lot of personal preference. We don't try to influence what our surveyors want to do, or you know what we want. We don't try to influence what we want them to do too much. We just kind of, you know, they know their areas best, and sort of, you know, their personal preference drives a lot of our selection, basically. Okay. My theory is that, you know, you have to be interested in mapping these lakes in order to map them well. If you're not interested, the data suffers big time. And we don't really have an interest in putting out something that isn't very, very good.
Right.
So that's part of it. It's, I don't know, from a business standpoint, maybe not the best business plan, but that's the way we do it.
Yeah.
Well, no, that makes sense though.
No, true. If it's, especially when you're kind of running off passion for it too, you gotta continue to fuel that. Right. And I kind of wondered about how that works. Cause I know I've checked out your guys' list before, specifically in Saskatchewan. And there was, I can't remember the name of it. There was one of the trout lakes up north, I believe. And I'm like, oh, that one's kind of random, but I'm like, it's also very handy because I was looking at the lakes up around there. And so, because with being Saskatchewan, you just think like Last Mountain, Deef, Tobin, right? Those would be like some of the more popular ones, and then there's just this stock trout lake. And I was like, there must be something else that goes into this other than just demand. So that's nice to know that it comes off of you guys who, like you said, you guys are fishermen in yourself. So I think that kind of helps with things as well, because it's obviously fishermen using the maps, and you guys kind of know what you're looking for too, rather than just some company that's just out there to survey, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that helps as well.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. No, that makes sense.
So with how many lakes have you guys actually done? Do you know?
Honestly, offhand, I don't know what the number is. It's got to be over 100 now. Okay. Like, we're going to add, and the size varies obviously quite dramatically from, you know, trout pond size lakes all the way up to Clearwater and the South Basin of Lake Winnipeg. But yeah, it's got to be over 100. I think this year alone we'll add around 20 new lakes. I think six or seven were in Saskatchewan, and the rest were a little bit further east in Manitoba and Ontario.
Okay.
Is like Lake Winnipeg, or what lake is like your most popular? Do you guys track like usage?
Well, with the Avenza app, we can really track, you know, downloads, because everything we, you know, it's all by lake. It's hard to tell with our Lowrance stuff, because we put so many maps on a chip. But with the Avenza stuff, it's trackable, and Lake Winnipeg is very high demand. Clearwater Lake, we were surprised, like crazy surprised, at how many people wanted that Clearwater map. I guess Logan, you mentioned you were out there too, but
I can see why they want it. That lake is is insane, and I was going to ask you, like, how hard is that to map? Because we were there 5 days and we got to fish one evening and one afternoon because of the winds.
Clearwater, both Lake Winnipeg and Clearwater are just terrible to map.
Yeah,
Clearwater, I dare say Clearwater was worse per unit area than Lake Winnipeg. Like it's more intricate, so you have to be tighter with all your passes and whatnot. And for some reason, it blows up and it's nasty so often. Mm-hmm. So our primary surveyor on Clearwater, he was going out in the middle of the night because it was calm. He would go out for like 6 hours in the dead black of night. And, you know,
it's dedication.
He'd, you know, be careful about it and had lights and all that. Yeah. And nobody else is crazy enough to be out there at that time. But yeah, it was, crazy. No,
that's,
the amount of dedication that goes into this.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. But to me, it makes sense that would be popular, because it's, I think that one, like obviously with Lake Winnipeg, you'd get a lot of, I'd say, locals more around there that would buy that. But I feel like Clearwater, you get a lot more people that are coming for a weekend trip that maybe do it once or twice a year, but you get a lot more destination anglers, if you want to call it that. And with a lake that's so big and basically round like that, like you got to have a map to kind of know where you want to set up, especially for Lakers and stuff. So I could kind of see why that makes sense. And then also, I don't know about the northern makeup of Lake Winnipeg, but from my understanding, most of it's just like, is it like 20 feet and shallower for that lake?
Well, the South Basin's generally shallow. It tops out at maybe like 30 until you get into the Hecla area, and then it gets quite deep and quite intricate as well.
Okay.
But there actually is a lot of nearshore structure on Lake Winnipeg, and actually we're gonna release a whole bunch more data in about a month or so for the South Basin, and it's kind of crazy how much certain parts have changed due to ice scouring in the past 5 years since we started surveying it in 2018. There's there's some really neat stuff. I don't know how fishy it is. We suspect that these gouges that showed up were things that happened last year, based on talking with Matt Cornell from Bruin Outfitting and Guiding. He was kind of out there seeing it in real time and then showing in the preliminary map afterwards. It's it's pretty crazy. I think we're gonna blow a lot of minds when we show this data.
With how much things have changed.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Oh, that's pretty sweet. So with that stuff, like I know I saw on your website the Wekusko Lake, can people request places to be done? Because I know, like, obviously there's the lodge there at Wekusko. Like, is that something that, like, a lodge could request, or is that just, once again, your guys' preference to go to and do that lake?
Yeah, we definitely listen to people who request lakes. Like, we have a sort of a request hotline, if you will, on our website. We take it into account. We pass it on to our surveying teams, and they kind of ultimately make the decision about if it's something they want to tackle or not. We're doing Rocky Lake. Already did Rocky Lake. We're going to release it this spring. So that's a pretty popular lodge lake up in northern Manitoba. We're working on Athapap. We'll probably tackle a variety of different lodge lakes in the very near future.
Right. Okay, that Rocky Lake, we fished it a couple of days when it was too windy to go on Clearwater, and it was, some of the rocks there, they're just nuts. Like, I hadn't really seen, like, obviously you fish shield lakes and stuff in Saskatchewan, but for the way that some of these rocks were and the rock shelves and stuff that you could see while you're fishing for smallies was just nuts. And I was like, we're out there blind pretty well, so we're just kind of, the first time we're heading to the spot, it's going slow, basically getting ourselves a safe path, because like you said, you don't want to take out lower units and stuff like that. But I couldn't believe that lake was pretty sweet. And would you say that lake's kind of like a medium size, like kind of a happy medium size, especially for mapping?
Yeah, it's I don't know. Yeah, about a middle of the road size lake for northern Manitoba anyway. It's got a lot of bass
that
in
makes
it.
Sense.
It's a crazy fishery.
Yeah, some big fat bass too. Not like lots of verging on that master. Like, I think master is 18, if I believe, in Manitoba for the smallies. And we caught so many in that like 17 range, and all had big bellies on them. And just we never actually did get a master there. We got some out of some other lakes, but like just the thickness of those fish was awesome. And we only have pretty well one public lake in Saskatchewan that has them, so we don't get to do that as often here, right?
Okay,
that was definitely a treat. And the lake that we have is pretty well Manitoba anyway, so it doesn't even doesn't even matter really, but the majority of the population is not close to it, so it's nice to get on those. But when you mentioned for Clearwater, you talked about a unit, like an area, is that what you guys refer them to, or does that make sense?
Per unit area.
Yeah, so yeah. What size is that?
I don't, it's just sort of a generic term.
Okay.
You know, like a square kilometer of area on Clearwater might take 10 times longer than a square kilometer of area on Lake Winnipeg or say Blackstrap Reservoir in Saskatchewan.
Right. Okay, so you can't really, you couldn't really even try to put like an average time it takes, because every lake, depending on how intricate it is, takes what it takes, basically. Like, you can't be like, oh, this should take us this long, because as soon as you get out there and see how detailed it is, that basically adds time to it, kind of thing.
Exactly. Yeah, like I can sort of predict, you know, based on the general area of where the lake's located, like if it's in the Canadian Shield, it's going to take a long time. If it's in Saskatchewan, and it doesn't have an old river channel, it doesn't take terribly long, typically. If it has an old river channel, like, say, Rafferty Reservoir, that takes a lot of time, like, to sort of capture those details accurately. It takes a lot of time. Yeah.
No doubt.
So when you say a lot of time, like, what is a time frame when you when you're going to your next targeted lake, you know, how long does that normally take to actually collect the data and be confident to put that out? Like, is this a yearly thing? Like, you know, how long does this actually take?
Small lakes, we measure our timelines in days. The big lakes, you know, we're getting into weeks, if not months, of solid time on the water. And you can't be on the water all the time, especially on the big lakes, because of wind. Yeah. So that's sometimes why, you know, it takes us 2 years to do a lake like Clearwater, because we're not going to force it. We're not going to do anything unsafe, first and foremost, but we're also not going to force bad data. Like when it's really windy and nasty out and your boat's bouncing around, so is your sonar. So there's no point in trying to, you know, force it. We just take our time and eventually we'll have a really, really good map.
You'll probably like this. I don't know. Most people probably wouldn't even admit this, but when I first time ever using sonar, when I got it from my boat, I don't know how young I was, but the very first one I got, it was some little square hummingbird. And I was out there on a wavier day and I'm like, there's like, this is some quite like the structure down there. Like this, those bottom is just up and down. And I'm like, what is going on here? So I'm like, well, this might be a not bad spot to fish. And keep in mind, I'm young. And then now obviously figured out pretty quick, this is because of the waves, but it took me a little bit to figure that out. And I always think back and laugh at that, especially when I see it out there now, when I'm on a big rough lake or whatever. And I'm like, I used to think that was just what the bottom was. Turns out it's just flat there, but yeah.
Yeah, we get comments sometimes, especially on lakes that are generally flat, about how, you know, my user mapping shows a lot more structure out here, and I'm like, yeah, it might, but I don't know if it's real.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing, real versus. Like you see some stuff too, and it's just, sometimes it is difficult to tell. And when you're in like really messy, rocky areas or on big drops and stuff like that, especially in the shield lakes, you just get some weird readings sometimes. And I'm like kind of, what is this? Turns out it's some kind of shelf or whatever, but sometimes you get that lighter reading and sure enough, you get snagged on it or something like that. And you kind of figure out what's going on. But like you said, depending on how much goes into setting up a sonar, right? Some people, their stuff isn't set up correctly, so of course it's going to be reading differently as well.
Yeah.
So there's obviously lots that goes into that. So you might be probably one of the best people to ask how someone should set up their transducer on the back of their boat.
Yeah. Well, it's a bit of an art, to be honest. Like, and it's hard to generalize between boat types. Like fiberglass hulls are very forgiving. You can mount your transducers in a lot of places and get a nice clean reading. Aluminum boats are tough in general, like rivets and strakes and, you know, everything. Every little disturbance in the water affects your transducer reading. If it's in line with your transducer, it'll create turbulent water and basically mess things up. Incidentally, people always say, like, you know, mount it on the left-hand side. If you're at the back of your boat and you're facing your motor, mount it on the left-hand side of the motor. They usually say on the right-hand side of the motor. I typically mount mine on the left because that's where I like to jig. I don't think it really makes that much of a difference, at least on, you know, boats that are 90 horsepower or less. And one other like crazy thing that we sort of realized with the big, long 3-in-1 style, like similar to the Mega transducers, on our Lunns, like 18-foot Lunns, we mounted right behind a strake, and it turned out that produced the best reading on the whole boat. Like, we'd been messing around with it forever and just kind of struggling with the readings, and then we put it behind the strake, and it was beautiful.
It's kind of messing around with it. I know when we're setting up our boats, when I head up guiding, and you got to put the boats in for the start of the year, right, and get everything set up again. I did the same as you. I always put it on my left side because I would jig off the left corner of the boat there, with the tiller, so it kind of get a better reading there. But lots of the other guys, I think they're saying it had something to do with the way that the prop turns, and better off to be on the right side as far as prop wash and stuff, because they're mapping going full tilt, so around 30 mile an hour lots of the time. Obviously not totally accurate, but it gives them a general idea when they're ripping around. And so they've got those down there, and then they put little metal blockers over top to stop the rooster tail from coming up too high and all that stuff. So I think I still keep mine on my left side, if I remember correctly, because I like having that reading right there when I am jigging. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I agree with you. I've heard that as well. I think my boat back home here is on the right side, but I didn't really even look into that. That's just where the mounting plate was for the boat, so that's where I put them basically. So I hadn't done too much research on that part of it, but
right.
So when you go to do a lake, like, do you just go do it, or do you have to get any type of like government approval or anything like that? Like, is the process pretty seamless? If you decide to go do a lake, you just, you know, pass it along to your surveyor and they kind of just go about it as they wish type thing? Or is there actually like a large approval process to actually get this data?
There's a few lakes that we've done that are electric motors only. So we've used kayaks and, you know, small boats with electric motors pushing them. Other than that, no, we haven't really had to pursue any permissions officially, I don't think.
Okay. Which makes sense, right? Everyone else has it on their boats to use it personally. The mapping functions, right? Lots of the times. So I don't know why it would be any different, but who knows with the way government is, I'm sure they could find a way to make you have to do something about that. But no, that makes sense there. And I guess when we talked about the amount of time it takes you to do a body of water, how much, on a percentage wise, if you can come up with it, how much dead water do you think you're going over when you're surveying?
In the context of, is there fish in it, you mean?
Yeah, like what, like how much do you, of the lake, like, you know how they say 90, like 10, 90% of the fish are, like, is it, did you find that to be true or?
Oh yeah, I think that's a very accurate generalization. Sometimes I think it's even maybe an underestimate, like the 90% of the fish are in 10% of the water. I often think about bass, and I feel like maybe not in the summer when they're on the shorelines and scattered everywhere, but like during the fall and during the winter, it's probably like 99% and 1%, right? Like they're so congregated in tiny little areas.
Right. I guess we should have asked you, are you a bass guy or a walleye guy? That should have been me at the top of the episode, so we know what we were getting into.
You might not have had me on here. I don't know.
No, we like them all. Burbot's our favorite, so we can't even really talk.
Oh, jeez.
Burb's the word.
My brother Rob is the bass guy. Okay. From our team. I consider myself a multi-species guy. I like
that's the best way to be.
crappie and lake trout in the winter, and I like walleye in the summer. Okay. I bass fish too. Like I do like all species really.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Because that would, like, when you're driving around, if you were just a walleye guy, you're going to be looking at totally different. Like when you come across something, you're going to be thinking about that probably totally different than a bass guy would, right? Or depending on whatever your species is, right? Because when you're going around, I'm sure you find some pretty sweet spots that you're like, yeah, I'll have to come back here and check it out, right? Like you basically turn that lake inside out, as you can tell from the picture behind you. So
yeah, totally. I actually stopped. I used to bring a fishing rod in the boat, and I stopped because, you know, it's so hard to, you know, keep going once you see, you know, opportunities to fish.
Mm-hmm.
And if you really want to get things done, it's, I don't know. That's the decision that I made, and some days I regret it, but,
I wouldn't get any mapping done. As soon as I found a spot that was holding fish, I just want to sit there the rest of the day.
Yeah,
totally. Yeah.
See, and we miss out on those opportunities for like crappie, like, and for bass. Like we're very limited here in Saskatchewan for those species. But like, yeah, I heard crappie's like unbelievable. And I lived in North Dakota for a little bit, so I got the chance to do a little bit down there. but never made the trip out east of Saskatchewan here to do any of that. But it's a blast. Like, if you can get on a bite, like we got perch, but I don't think it's the same.
Perch are fun. Big perch are fun.
That's true.
I definitely like them, but crappie, they just school up and they sit so high in the water column sometimes, and you can, in the fall you can get on them in huge numbers, and they're just willing biters. Yeah, you should really come out to the Whiteshell area in Manitoba, because it is crazy for big crappie right now.
So out of every option, that's what's your number one? Is that it for crappie?
Like, in terms of where to go?
If a guy, in Manitoba. If a guy from Saskatchewan, you know, if we were to make a trip out there, where would you recommend? Yeah,
for crappie, I would definitely go to the Whiteshell. The other really, really good one is actually the lake that's in my background there. Lac de Bonnie is taking off as a crappie fishery. They got in there, I don't know, maybe a couple decades ago. People were catching them in low numbers, but they have started to boom. So that's one to keep your eye on. If you were to go like right now,
is that white?
If you were to go right now, I would say the Whiteshell is better, but in 2 to 3 years, okay, I would expect that Lac de Bonnie is, you know, world class for crappie.
Yes.
Is that why it's framed on your wall behind you?
Yeah, partially. I think it's a really pretty lake in general, with the old river channel, and yeah.
So how deep is that purpley blue section there behind you?
Purple on the Lac de Bonnie print map starts at about 50 feet. So it's not crazy deep. Right where you can sort of see there.
Yeah.
If you were to go a little bit further north, it drops down to maybe about 90 near the MacArthur Falls Dam.
Okay.
Sweet. Yeah.
Sweet.
That's pretty deep, though.
Oh, for what we see in Saskatchewan, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, not compared to Diefenbaker, it's like 200.
True. Yeah, that Diefenbaker's an outlier.
Wow.
Yeah. I guess Last Mountain has some deeps, too.
It's built different.
Nothing is, Last Mountain's nowhere near as deep, obviously, as Deef is, but that's, Deef is built different. That's for sure. That's a whole nother beast. Yeah. I remember the first time I went out there, I was like 14, and we're out there in the fishing boat. We just launched at Elbow there, and we're out right in the middle of the whole thing with no idea what we're doing, just driving around. I'm like, this is like 200 some feet or something like that. I was like, this is ridiculous. Like, what are we? We leave Buffalo Pound that morning where it's the deepest at 16 feet for the whole entire lake, and then we're at Diefenbaker. It's like, oh my goodness, this is a whole nother animal. And still haven't cracked the code there totally at Deef. So that's what keeps us coming back.
Are you fishing for walleye at Deef, or are you guys going for trout and whitefish and stuff like that?
In the summer there, I typically have just gone for trout. I've tried a couple times for walleye. I actually have never caught a walleye there. Every time I go there, it seems to be mostly for trout. I think I've tried once or twice for a walleye when I was younger, but basically trout in the summer and fall, and then burbot and pike in the winter is kind of the targets for me. I know if you head down south there more into the river, that can be really good for walleye and stuff, but kind of for us right around Elbow there is about an hour drive, something like that. So we typically just head out there and see what we can find. It's just such a different lake and so different than us typically hitting Buffalo Pound or Last Mountain or whatever. So it's just kind of fun to do something different there. If we want walleye, we're lucky we're close to Last Mountain, where obviously no secret, everyone knows how good Last Mountain can be too. So that's we're kind of spoiled sitting in the middle of these two lakes. So it's definitely hard to choose some days what you want to go and do.
Right on. So, okay, that brings me to a question then.
Yeah.
If you guys had a choice, how would you prioritize, you know, sort of the next projects that we would do in Saskatchewan? Like, is Last Mountain the sort of, you know, next place that we should look at, or Tobin, or?
I honestly think with Last Mountain, so many people that do fish that lake hard have it pretty well all mapped already. It seems not like maybe as in depth, But so many of those tournament guys, from what I saw with the little bit that I've been out with some of them, is they've pretty well, I think it's more Humminbird there, but whether it's the social maps and stuff that Humminbird has, everyone seems to have it figured out pretty good for the most part. I don't know about Tobin as much. So I would be kind of, that one would kind of interest me, because you've got the river section that then flows out into the main lake there. So I think that could be interesting. And then you've also got the flats. If you want to talk about taking lower ends off, you go to the flats and hit some deadheads and stuff like yeah. that. So it's, I think Tobin could be a cool one, because it's with the vanity, that's a big draw for a lot of serious anglers, and they've got some resorts yep. there and stuff like that. So I don't know really what there is available, because when we went up there for the vanity, we didn't take my boat or any of my stuff. So I don't know what's already available, kind of thing. But I do know I've seen tons of guys' sonars from Last Mountain that were anywhere we're driving, they've seemed to have mapped. So I don't know if you'd get those guys as much, but I know Last Mountain has a name out there for good fishing. So there's probably lots of destination anglers there as well. So it'd be tough to say.
I was just going to say the demand would be pretty high, I think, for
both,
you know, either one of those lakes. I think Tobin would definitely be a little bit more diverse and is, maybe a little less figured out maybe by a lot of people. Me personally, right? Like, I don't spend a whole lot of time in the north. So Tobin is honestly, I have no idea what Tobin has to offer as far as, you know, as a lake. But yeah, Last Mountain Lake, if people are putting in the time, most of the time they have it pretty figured out. But that being said, I think there's a lot of people that have not figured it out or haven't had the time to do yeah. that, right? Like, it's majority your tournament anglers that have it all mapped out, right? So it's your general public people that don't have a boat or the time to be out there every weekend mapping. I think it'd be something that a lot of people would mm-hmm. want to have and not have to spend the time to go do it themselves. But, you know, a lot of people too, they want to go figure it out themselves as well. But I think Last Mountain Lake, you'd get a lot of demand.
Our requests, I would say, for Saskatchewan, Tobin and Last Mountain are number one and two. Well, yeah. after people started learning that we're actually doing Diefenbaker.
So
I was just curious, but it sounds like it's kind of like same. 50-50.
Yeah. I'd be interested. I think there could be some really cool ones like Lac La Ronge and stuff like that farther north. Mm-hmm. Like there, we've got yeah. some pretty cool lakes. I know I've done just a little bit of mapping on some of the lakes that I go to up there, and it's just, like you said, those shield lakes are so intricate, and it's so cool once you do fill out an area. Like, once you can fill, like, when you can zoom out a bit on your map, see a good area, but you can see that you've filled that entire area, as I'm sure you've seen a ton. I've only done that a couple of times, and it looks so cool once it is done, especially in those northern lakes. So I would have, like, personal ones that I think would be cool up there, but as far as the actual demand, there's not many people going to these lakes. Like, I've talked to lots of buddies who fish a lot, and they're like, I haven't even heard of that lake. Why are you going there, kind of thing? I was like, I don't know. I just saw it on the side of the road and kind of want to put my boat in and see what's in there.
Turned yeah. off. And
yeah. So, no, it's tough to say. And I guess for Deef, I know you mentioned it's only a section of it, right? So what area have you guys mapped that you're going to be eventually releasing?
So we've mapped everything east of, I think it's called Hitchcock Bay. So, like, there's the you know, the Koto arm, and then
yeah.
I'm trying to remember the name of the other arm that goes sort of south, east of that, and then it sort of turns west, and there's a big elbow there, at elbow. And then we go until it turns again, kind of. So it is a big area. It is a really big area.
Right.
There's more to it. And I imagine it gets shallower as you go to the west, and it kind of becomes less like a reservoir and more like a river. But we're pretty excited about this release. It's intricate.
So you're saying from Hitchcock, everything northeast of there, basically. So you go all the way up to the dam and then all the way to the Qu'Appelle Dam as well?
Yep.
Oh, cool. Okay. Well, that's pretty popular area of the lake there. So that makes sense. And so that basically, when I was talking about going out on to D for the first time, it was basically where that Y is. And that's where I was out in the middle there, like, where am I? kind of thing. So yeah, No, that is a big chunk of that lake and a very popular chunk. I know around Riverhurst and stuff is popular as well. But that's some massive water that you guys covered there then. I didn't realize it was the northern part as well. So that's pretty sweet.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Lots of time. So with that kind of thing, are you guys like camping out for a couple days at these places, or like what's a typical, I guess, week for a surveyor look like?
Yeah, we've done day tripping from Saskatoon. We've done camping out basically right on the lake. A little bit of both. It kind of depends on the weather. Like, Dieff is big enough that, you know, weather can screw up your plans pretty good, yeah, too, especially a west big wind. Time. North wind, too. Yeah. So you kind of just got to play it by ear.
Yeah, that's Dieff in a nutshell. Like the wind and stuff can come up so quick there too. Like with it being basically, yeah, filled to the top of the valley, there's no protection really from anything, right? So
yep,
that lake's a beast that deserves to be respected, and unfortunately there is every couple of years, it seems, there is some people that lose their lives out there because that lake just turns so quick. And it's a popular place for people that really aren't water people or lake people as much, right? They go to the beach or something like that, and maybe they got a kayak or something, and then all of a sudden weather picks up and things can change there so quick. So yeah, that would be, I would say, would you say that's probably one of the hardest parts of this job is the weather with lots of these lakes?
It is. It's hard to plan, and just, you know, sometimes you just have to be ready to go, like especially late in the year when you're getting close to a lake being done and releasable, and you really want to get it done, and you're just kind of watching the weather for like one good day, you know, before the ice starts to form, and you're out there and it's cold, and you get, you know, a nice calm day, but it's still cold late in the fall. So
mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's the challenge, yeah, for sure. I honestly, like, we've finished up, I think I've mentioned this already, but we finished up the south basin of Lake Winnipeg, or more or less. We're not really going to touch the far east side because nobody really goes there. But that's been a 3-year project to sort of fill in the holes of, you know, the areas that we haven't already released. And okay, it's just because the days, yeah, are so few when you can get out there and actually, you know, be safe and collect good data.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. It's already frustrating enough when you're just trying to go out fishing, let alone you're just trying to go out and map, right? Like if you go out there and your day gets pulled up to the water, like, man, this is way worse than I thought it was going to be. It's like, it's going to be a bumpy day, but to actually have to go out there and get information, like you can stick fish when the waves are up, obviously, but when you're trying to get good solid data, like you talk about, that'd be pretty,
it's impossible. You just, yeah, you can't, you're going, you turn around and you go home and you lick your wounds and hope that tomorrow's better.
Yeah, no, that makes sense.
Yeah, no, that's fair for sure. I guess for the folks listening at home, do you have any tips on, you know, how they can get the best accurate mapping on their units? Because obviously, you know, there's a lot of people that do, you know, have the time and put in the work to go map out on their own units and stuff. Like, is there any tips or tricks that you can give for people at home that want to go map out a little area on their own?
Well, the biggest thing is to get your transducer mounted properly, and we sort of talked about that.
Okay.
Like it's very rare, even for me who's mounted transducers on 30 or 40 boats over the course of my life, it's very rare that you get the placement right to begin with. So make sure, yeah, you put on a piece of transducer board, puck board, starboard, whatever material you want to put on your hull, but you don't want to be drilling lots of holes in your hull, obviously. And I think some people, you know, because of that, they just stick with the position that they, you know, initially mount the boat, the transducer on their boat at the factory, or, you know, after they get it home and they buy a unit. And that's, you know, you're just, it's hopeless, to be honest. Mm-hmm. Some of the time, if you have it mounted too high or too low, or, you know, even rivets can throw off the turbulence and create bad signals, and then you're just fighting it the whole time. If you could get your transducer mounted properly, you know, you just make your life so much easier from the context of user mapping.
Right. And so that would be, you're talking probably recording at like higher speeds.
Yeah, definitely. Like, you don't, if you're just trolling and you're not even on plane ever, you know, you're okay pretty much however you have it mounted, as long as your angle is right. That's another part of the equation, is you want the right angle. But the reality is when most people are fishing and, you know, they're logging their data and auto charting or whatever, they're driving as well. Like, as soon as you start driving over your fishing spot, you inject this bad data. And you gotta, exactly. It's confusing and it's hard to recover from that. You gotta go into your unit and manually delete data points. And, you know, that's when it stops being fun. When you're managing data, I think.
When you're having to deal with that all the time. And I guess you did say, obviously, as people could imagine, some of this is like some proprietary information, as we talked about before. But would you have any insight into kind of, I've looked at some of the stuff and it's crazy how many lakes are mapped in the States. Is this all being done similar to how you guys do it? Or are people, is there different ways that you can do this other than driving around with your boat? Like, is, like, I've heard some people talk about satellite. You're like, is that actually a thing? Like, how do they have so many more lakes mapped than we do, like official maps?
I think there's just a huge demand down there. The angling industry is orders of magnitude more valuable, if you will, than it is in Canada. There's just a greater population base. And I think in general, people have come around to the value of maps sooner. It'll you know, catch on, I think, more and more in Canada as well, now that people have kind of had a taste of good quality mapping. But we also have so much more water relative to the amount of people compared to the United States as well.
Right. So I guess the second part to that is, how can some of these maps be off by so much? Like, my one buddy, I think he was using Navionics at Last Mountain, and we went to drill a hole where it was 24 feet and we drilled into mud. Like, how have you seen that before with these? Like, is that just kind of, is there, you got some points and it just assumes what the rest of it is between those points? Or like, how can that stuff happen? Do you have an idea on that?
I don't know exactly how other companies use the data or what data they have. I can infer a few things in Manitoba, at least based on what I see on the digital maps from other companies and what I see on like the old printed government maps. And I think, you know, for a lot of lakes, that is, they use the old government data, which was collected you know, a long time ago, pre-GPS days. People were probably, you know, taking a sounding and then trying to triangulate manually, shoreline features and whatnot. And you just, honestly, I'm impressed that the maps are as good as they were.
Right.
Given what those surveyors had at their disposal. But the reality is, it's just, you know, it's not very good data to begin with. So there's a lot of potential for error when you're interpolating your data and creating a map.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. I wonder, as I've checked out some of those old maps that are like from 1960 whatever, and it is, like you said, it is impressive how accurate some of them are in general terms, I guess, right? Not maybe the intricacies of a lake, but to have those general depths correct, it actually, I found it quite impressive. And a lot of this stuff just fascinates me because it's so cool getting to basically peel away the water and see a full complete project basically. But I've always been interested in those, especially, like I said, some of the lakes that I'm looking at talk to people. No, I've never been there. Never been there. There's nothing about it online except for some map from 1982. And it's like, oh, this is all I got to go off of.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Do you want to come work for Angler's Edge Mapping? You sound like,
maybe I fit that type.
Yeah.
No, that makes sense. I guess, did you have anything else, Brandon, or should we get into some of the questions from the listeners?
No, yeah, let's dive into those. I mean, there's obviously, you know, we're in Saskatchewan, so there's a lot of Saskatchewan-based topics. And I guess, you know, what is the horizon for Sask Lakes? Like, is Saskatchewan, you know, going to be a high demand place in the coming years here for you guys? Are you guys just going to be kind of focusing on those two bigger lakes, you know, that we talked about, aside from Deef that you guys are already on? Are you guys wanting to dive into some more of those more remote lakes up north that, you know, people go to that maybe just aren't as well known? What's that look like?
Yeah, I always try to be a little bit careful with these sort of questions, because we have plans, tentative plans. We have, you know, people involved that have their own plans, but we've got into the situation a few times where we thought something was getting done and we let people know, and then it didn't happen, or it didn't happen on the timeline that we originally thought. Yeah. So yeah, I always sort of temper the whole, when is it going to get done? In terms of if it's going to get done, yeah, we are really actually focused on Saskatchewan, and plan to do a lot in Saskatchewan. Okay. Over the next few years. We've got you know, a good team established now, and you know, we're making progress. Deef is a huge hurdle. Like, we did almost 8,000 kilometers of survey on Deef. And if we did 8,000 kilometers of survey on Last Mountain and Tobin, they would be done.
Right.
Right. So it's, you know,
pick your battles, basically.
We got to pick our battles, but yeah, you know, it's not going to take us that long. And I think it'll be worth it.
Yeah, for sure. And I guess, just so people have reference, before 2023, you guys had two Saskatchewan lakes on your list, with Lake of the Prairies, with a bordering lake, and then Mage Lake. And then since, or I guess new for 2023, it looks like you guys added six lakes. So Blackstrap, Crooked, I don't know how to pronounce this, Ispachow Lake, I think. Is that correct? Is that how you say it? Kind of.
I'm not going to correct you, put it that way.
Yeah, and then Kit Lake, Sealy Lake, and Shannon Lake. So Sealy and Shannon being one of the ones I was talking about at the top of the episode there, in the north there. And then obviously now we've talked about Deef and Baker. So, I mean, you've already gone from two to now eight. So that's pretty big jump there in 2023 alone. And, I mean, some of those being smaller, but also pretty cool lakes as well. Like I said, when you can get some information on some of those northern lakes, that's pretty neat to see. So I think that's pretty good. I mean, we did, obviously, like Brandon said, had lots of questions about that. We actually had one for Buffalo Pound as well. Obviously, that's I don't know how interesting you'd find that. I kind of call it a mud bathtub. There's not too much going on there. There would be a little
Logan,
bit.
Logan, you maybe could do that one in like an afternoon.
Yeah, I mean, with all the time I spend out there, I probably should map it a bit more. But it's like, oh, I found a drop. It goes from 8 feet to 11 feet. It's like, there's not really much going on there. But I guess one thing you kind of hit on it a bit near the start of the interview. But we had a question here from Jesse, and he was kind of asking how much you notice things changing. Like, for example, he says he notices how much Fox's Point changes at Last Mountain throughout the years. So when you guys have done multi-year projects, is, you kind of mentioned it, but do you see that happen quite often with changes, especially in river systems and stuff like that?
Yeah. So on the Shield, everything's very stable.
Right.
Rivers change a lot. And while Angler's Edge Mapping hasn't mapped Tobin, I've actually spent a lot of time on Tobin. I'm a fisheries biologist by trade, so
okay.
I did some work for SAS okay. Power out on Tobin Lake in 2013, 2014 and 2015. And the transition zone from the river to Tobin, it changes dramatically. Like, we were there at a time when there was basically two major floods.
Oh, okay.
And it just, we had a hydroacoustic receiver to track fish movements deployed right in the transition zone. And so basically you put an anchor down and then you float this receiver that detects the fish halfway up in the water column. So it's suspended, you know, 10 feet off the bottom. And we deployed it like that in, I want to say, October. And then we came back in May to retrieve it. And the float that was 10 feet off the bottom was buried in sand. We could see it ever so slightly off the bottom. So, yeah, the scale of change, the magnitude of change on the Saskatchewan River, which has a massive amount of sediment load, is crazy, right? Like, those transition zones are in constant flux, which from a mapping standpoint is challenging for sure, because if you really wanted to be accurate, super accurate, you're surveying it every year for sure. So we kind of know what we're getting into with Tobin, because I've spent so much time out there. And we kind of have a plan to deal with that. And it's going to involve resurveying it continually, where there is change happening. Right. Not all of the lake is going to change, but that transition zone is always going to change.
Right. So that's why you guys have probably a disclaimer. Maps are subject to change due to environmental conditions.
Yeah. Like, you can only do so much, but, we're fortunate, I guess, in that most of our lakes don't really change that much. We wondered how much change Lake Winnipeg would experience when we started mapping it, because, well, first of all, nobody really understood how much structure and intricacy there was out in the South Basin. I think we opened up a lot of eyes. But we also, you know, started wondering, well, what are we getting ourselves into? Like, are we going to have to resurvey this thing every year? Like, people talk about the mud shifting in the sand and all that. And what we've actually found is that the areas that we thought would be most prone to change, like the near shore areas, they're not changing much. They're very stable. And where we have observed change is way out in the middle. And it's to do with these ice scours that I was mentioning before. Okay. And so quite unexpected.
Right. Yeah. Well, I'm sure I could see it too. I don't know if it would have any reason to think this, but in some of those closer to shore areas, I'm sure those have been grinded upon year after year. And I could see them being quite solid probably at this point, right? Whereas if you get some anomaly out in the middle, that in places that aren't hit as much too, I could see that maybe creating more of a divot there, like just not as much resistance. Would that make sense too, kind of thing?
To a point, yeah, I think it would. Like, it's definitely mud out in the middle, and where these sort of ice scours are happening, you can see the mud push up, you know, multiple feet, sometimes 8 feet high. And the bottom type closer to shore is more sand, cobble, a little bit harder material. So it would be less prone, but I'm still kind of surprised that it doesn't move as much as it isn't.
Right. Yeah. No, that makes sense. And I got one last one that I had here for you. When you talked, like, it even says on your website, talking about propellers and lower units and stuff like that. How often are you changing out propellers and stuff like that? Pretty common.
Yeah, it's, I don't have any hard numbers on me, but it's a lot. We don't really want people using their own boats when they survey for us, because the probability of damage if you're putting in any length of time, surveying is just, it's so high. So like we almost insist that people use our, you know, Angler's Edge mapping equipment. Oh, okay. So that they're not risking damaging their own stuff.
Right. No, that makes sense. And I guess it also makes sense that those things happen because, as you can tell from the map behind you, you're not just mapping the fishing areas, right? Like you're doing the entire lake. And so you're going into some places that I'm sure lots of people don't typically go anyways, like in lots of those shallow areas, but you guys are mapping the whole thing. And so that's where you're going to find some oopsies
and yeah, stuff totally. There, right? It yeah. sounds cliche, but we're going out hunting for rocks, essentially. Like
pretty well, yeah.
We're finding the rocks so that you don't
people
have
don't
to.
Have yeah. to.
Doing God's work out
yeah.
there.
Okay, that's yeah. a little strong. But
well, I mean, with the price of boats and stuff and the type of engines that guys are running out there, that's a big mistake. It's a lot different than when you'd hit that with your 30 horse or something like that, right? Like this is way different. So I could only imagine the sickening feeling that is. And like I've nicked rocks and stuff while guiding, but not going very fast, and even that's just a gross feeling. So I can only imagine when, especially with the equipment and stuff that you guys would be out there all the time with, it's like, oh, kind of, does it get to the point like, oh, there's another one? Or is it still kind of every time like, oh man?
Last year it was bad. Like, I don't know what it was about last year, but we just, we had three motors down with lower ends needing to be totally replaced. And we're struggling to get parts and it was not a good one.
Okay. So last one, how bad was Deef for that stuff? I know I've been ripping out there and we've hit sandbars in the middle of the lake. Like got lucky. It was just a sandbar, no rock really. But like how much of that happened at Deef, if at all?
Just one catastrophic hit that took out a lower end. Okay. I honestly don't think we lost any props on Deef. Just lower end.
Okay.
And it was something that I don't even think, if memory serves, we weren't actually surveying at the time. We're just heading back to the launch. So we're going pretty good in an area that we hadn't surveyed yet. Mm. and yeah, it was bad. And then the water level dropped like a week later and, you know, we could see visually what it was.
What
it was like,
was.
Holy crap. That thing came like, it was 60 feet deep and it came up to 6 inches on that particular day. And then a week later it was out of the water. You would have never hit it, but
yeah. That lake's a beast. It is different for sure. It's a nightmare for that stuff. Like I said, when we went through the sandbar that we hit, like we were going like 30 mile an hour and it slowed us down. It stopped us. Didn't really do anything other than obviously like scrape some paint and stuff, but it was enough to stop us. And then we had to basically push the boat through the rest of the sandbar. But like you said, they come out of nowhere. Like we're a couple hundred yards offshore and then boom, sandbar. There's nothing around that would show any of it. So I can definitely feel your pain there, but I guess we've kept you for an hour here. I guess for yourself and Angler's Edge, where can everyone find you? Kind of plug away that stuff so people know where they can go find some prints. Obviously, you guys have apparel too, but where they can get the maps and stuff as well.
Sure. So we have a website, www.anglersedgemapping.com, and you can order pretty much everything that we've got from our website. We are on Facebook and we're pretty active on it. We have an Instagram page and I think that's it. We sort of did the YouTube thing for a little bit, but honestly, we haven't really been making many videos recently.
Okay. Okay. No, that's fair. And they answer very quick on their Facebook, as I found out to set up this interview too. So that's always nice to see from a company, but we appreciate you taking the time in your evening to come on here. And I think people are going to really enjoy this episode. I found it quite interesting and something a little different than just the fishing thing. So thanks for coming on.
No worries.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Craig.
No, thank you guys. This was fun.
Well, I hope you guys enjoyed that episode. I know for myself, I found that very interesting. Obviously, like we said in the episode, it's not directly fishing, Obviously, it plays a huge part in fishing, anything to do with maps. But I found that very interesting, kind of getting to know how some of that stuff works and all the behind the scenes work that goes into it. I know, we were talking with Craig there. It's like people just buy these maps, plug it in, then they start to look for where they want to fish, right? Like people don't really think about all this work that goes into making some of these maps. And if you haven't checked out their maps before, they're incredible. The colors that they got with them, everything like that, they're pretty sweet. We didn't talk about it too much, but you can download the Avenza Maps app, which is where they upload all their stuff to and purchase the lakes and stuff that you want from there. And then you can, when you're bored, whatever, when you're not on the water, go around and just search around on some of these lakes that you're thinking about fishing or ones that you currently fish. But I really enjoyed that episode. So thanks a lot to Craig for coming on. It was very, very interesting and definitely something I'd like to maybe learn a little more about. But what do you think, Brandon?
Yeah, no, super cool. And I think it's fantastic that they're going to be broadening all of their maps into Saskatchewan a little bit more. You know, even like you mentioned in the episode in 2023, they added 6 lakes, right? Yeah. So now they're up to 8 lakes in the province and they're just going to continue to do more. And, you know, I think there's a lot of lakes that, aside from the big ones that we talked about, there's a lot of lakes that would be super beneficial to a lot of people that get up to a little bit more remote areas and stuff. So super cool. You know, hopefully they do, you know, get quite a few lakes in the next few years. But obviously we heard it takes time and weather's a big factor. So, but when they come, great. That'll be super exciting. So Thank you guys so much for tuning in. Make sure you head over to rapella.ca. Use our code Weekend Warriors. Just got back from my first ever lake trout trip up north in Saskatchewan there. Caught my first lake trout using the Rapella
Shadow Wrap.
That was super cool. So go check those out. Those are super, you know, super lucrative lures for multi-species, right? Like use those for walleye quite a bit, but The lake trout, we're biting them. So
Lakers love them.
Go check those out, as well as write all your 13 fishing rods, reels, Strike Master, you know, ice augers, all that kind of stuff. You get 15% off the entire website. So that is pretty wicked. So yeah,
use that code, get the stuff ready for the winter Weekend Warriors March Madness Classic, because at the time of this episode, I think this is going to come out on, what's that date going to be? The 17th, I believe. No, 10th. So you still got time. They ship crazy fast. It usually only takes a couple days to get to you. Head over there, get some stuff ready for the tournament. It's going to be a doozy. We've already got quite a few people signed up, and it's only going to get better. Sign-ups always come in quicker once we get closer to the event. So definitely head over to the Angler's Atlas website, click the events tab, and look for the Weekend Warriors March Madness Classic. Get yourself signed up and get ready to catch some fish. We'll see you in the next episode.
Thanks for tuning in to the Weekend Warriors Fishing Podcast. If you enjoyed the show, be sure to leave a review on your favorite listening platform so we can reach more anglers just like you. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube for media updates and behind-the-scenes content.